fix. I don't think they're necessarily singling him out. I think that some of the rhetoric from the senior members of the administration, including the president himself, have resulted in an increased enforcement across the board. But unfortunately, there's also been a lot of rhetoric regarding Haitians. And as a result, I do think that there's been an increased targeting of Haitian nationals.
But there is a stay on the deportation of Haitians until January. Why is this happening now, Tejin?
I think November is why it's happening now, Tejin. What happened in November, the election, has resulted in a change in policy towards Haitians specifically.
Does Jean go to jail in Haiti if he is deported?
That is a concern of ours. There have been reports that deportees to Haiti have been imprisoned.
Yes, and what would that mean, Jean?
Well, once you get deported from here as a criminal alien, there's a process you got to go through in Haiti. You got to be interviewed by the Haitian government, and then you have to have a family member to come and sign you off. I have no family in Haiti. All my family lives over here now. You know, and if you can't get out, you got to pay money to get out. They are making money off criminal deportees in Haiti. And people have died in the Haitian jails now.
I mean, I certainly remember the jail collapsing at the time of the earthquake.
I talked to a friend of mine in Haiti last week. He said people are dying in those jails. Those jails used to put 50 people, and they have 400 people in them.
So we have 10 seconds. What can happen tomorrow in the ICE check-in? What are you calling for, Joshua?
We're just asking for ICE to allow Jean to continue to check in, as he has been doing for years without incident.
For 12 years now, I've been checking in.
How often?
Once a month. It started once a month, and they started giving me every 6 months. Until last month, they asked me, will you give me another month? I want to be able to stay here, get the case reopened, for the BIA to have the case reopened.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there, but we'll certainly continue to cover this case. I want to thank Jean Montreville, Janiyah Hurd, Jean's daughter, and Joshua Bar-David, his attorney. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland right now with the evening news, and they'll be right up.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Self-Care Day of Celebration, July 24th from 4 to 7 p.m. at World Pulse in Portland. Hosted by advocate and author Della Ray, this self-care day of celebration includes exhibitors, food and drink, interactive stations, and is a reminder to encourage the practice of self-care. Again, that's the Self-Care Day of Celebration on July 24th from 4 to 7 p.m. at World Pulse Headquarters, 411 Northeast 19th Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the screening of Promised Land July 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Rivergate Church in Portland. Promised Land is a social justice documentary that follows two tribes in the Pacific Northwest, the Duwamish and the Chinook, as they fight for restoration of treaty rights that have long since been denied. The film examines the way that government and society still look at tribal sovereignty. Again, that's a screening of the documentary film Promised Land, July 24th at 6:30 p.m. at the Rivergate Church, 7634 Southwest Capitol Highway in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly business organizations and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, wildfires are burning across western North America, causing property damage and numerous evacuations.
The Supreme Court has allowed the administration's travel ban to continue, though the definition of close family has been expanded to include grandparents.
And officers with the Baltimore Police Department caught themselves on videotape planting drugs.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 19th, 2017. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Wildfires have been burning in Oregon over the past week, causing health problems and spurring at least one evacuation. Monday, a 30-acre wildfire in Columbia County, Oregon, was put out by the Clatskanie Rural Fire Protection District and several other agencies. At one point, Highway 47 was blocked by the fire. The Oregon Department of Forestry and Columbia River Fire and Rescue, Napa Fire, Mist Birkenfeld Fire, Scappoose Fire, and Forest Grove Fire Departments have been busy fighting it. Smoke from the conflagrations has been blowing through the Columbia Gorge at times and has caused pulmonary distress as far west as Fairview, Oregon. In Klamath Falls, Oregon, yesterday, some homeowners were cleared out near Flowers Road, and a larger evacuation was being considered at one point yesterday morning. Multiple agencies and aerial tankers successfully fought the blaze near Highway 97, which at one point threatened several institutions, including the Super 8 Motel, a pilot truck stop, and mobile home parks. Wildfire conditions are far worse in Victoria, British Columbia, where an emergency order evacuating 45,000 people is being extended into a third week. Crews are making progress on the several dozen fires in that area, and air quality warnings for the Vancouver, British Columbia area were lifted today as winds shifted the smoke away.
Happy first birthday to Bike Town. In 1 year, 72,000 different riders covered over 206,000 miles on the orange bicycles, more than enough to get to the moon and back. The city continues to tweak distribution of the bikes, with more being added to northeast Alberta and parts of southeast Portland last month. Today only, you can fill out a form at the Metro website and get a free 3-hour ride. Again, that's today only. On Friday, officials will kick off an adaptive use bike share pilot program for Portlanders with physical disabilities.
Summer is a carefree time for many kids in Oregon, but can cause headaches for parents and teachers worried about kids slipping away from their academic achievements. Many more well-off parents can put their kids in summer programs to give them opportunities for year-round learning. Not everybody can afford these programs, however, and in rural areas, they are often non-existent. A program out in eastern Oregon is trying to reverse that trend. KBOO reporter Sam Bowman has more in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
Kids cherish summer as a time when they are free from school, but the lack of academics can leave them behind in class the next year. That's especially the case for students from low-income families, who often don't have the resources for summer learning opportunities. Add to that the challenges for rural communities, and the hurdles to keeping kids on track can sometimes look insurmountable. Enter Baker City in eastern Oregon. The district is in its second year of its successful program, Summer Academy. Mark Whitty, the superintendent of the Baker School District, who oversees the academy, talks about the challenges summer presents for students without a learning program.
Those students will have a tendency to do what's called the summer slide. And so they finish in May at a certain level in literacy and in math skills, and they'll start below that in September.
The Baker City program received grants from Umpqua Bank and charitable groups such as the Ford Family Foundation, and is run in partnership with 9 organizations, including the Baker County Public Library, YMCA, Baker Heritage Museum, and others. Whitty says the academy is interactive and almost like a camp. The students take field trips every week of the program. Whitty says in its first year, the program successfully kept students from sliding, and this year enrollment has increased from about 120 to 180 students. He says schools are the centers of community activity in rural areas, and that the program is successful because of the many community partners working together on this.
So I think collaboration really is critical, probably everywhere, but certainly in a rural community. If you can collaborate, I think that makes a large difference on what are the types of programming that you can offer.
Whitty says the sooner school districts and communities recognize the importance of providing learning opportunities year-round, the better off they will be.
The success of our schools, the success of our students, that's going to directly relate to our economic value over time. And so for us to get a student to the seventh grade that's ready to learn and on track with their peers, that's a big deal.
For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with the Oregon News Service, I'm Sam Bowman. For this piece, Oregon News Service spoke to Mark Whitty, the superintendent of the Baker School District.
Supreme Court today, hello again, the Supreme Court today allowed the Trump administration to enforce restrictions through its travel ban on six Muslim countries, Muslim-majority countries. But it let stand a court order from Hawaii expanding the definition of, quote, close relatives who must be admitted to the U.S. if they want to come and visit family. Last month, the State Department interpreted the ruling to exclude grandparents, grandchildren, uncles, aunts, nephews, nieces, cousins, and brothers and sisters-in-law. The Supreme Court today reversed that interpretation. The current limited travel ban is the Trump administration's third attempt after the two previous were rejected by federal courts. The Supreme Court will hear arguments on this law in October.
A new international report on global warming, led by noted climate scientist James Hansen, says curtailing CO2 emissions will not be enough to prevent ecological disaster. To keep warming in check, scientists call for programs to remove CO2 that's already in the air, what they call negative emissions. With current CO2 atmospheric concentrations currently over 400 parts per million, simply adding less CO2 won't be enough to reach the recognized goal of 350. The report urges immediate actions in CO2 reductions, as the cost of such actions will only increase as the situation worsens. The peer-reviewed study was published yesterday in Earth System Dynamics, a journal of the European Geosciences Union.
Now we go to the Green News Report, produced by blogger and investigative journalist Brad Friedman, along with Desi Doyen.
This happened so quickly, the crews had no opportunity really to fight the fire.
Raging wildfires in British Columbia forced nearly 40,000 to evacuate. Trump administration reduces royalty payments on offshore drilling. Energy Department's electric grid study contradicts claims by the Energy Secretary. Plus,
clean air, clean water, clean soil, that's where we get our food. It is what we live from.
Catholic nuns build outdoor chapel to block natural gas pipeline.
They're having none of it. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
We have nearly 100 years worth of natural gas and more than 250 years worth of clean, beautiful coal.
And several million years of actually clean, actually beautiful sunshine, which you would know, Mr. President, if you looked up every now and again from your meetings with the fossil fuel industry. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I don't know that this could possibly be a good omen, but I see that Tropical Storm Dawn is now forming in the Atlantic Ocean.
Yes, it is.
That can't be good.
The National Hurricane Center announced Monday that Tropical Storm Dawn has formed in the Atlantic Ocean. It's not Donald, but Dawn. Hurricane names for the 2017 season were set way back in 2006, so it's only a coincidence that the name is similar to the current occupant of the White House.
That won't keep him from going after the National Weather Service, however, if Tropical Storm Dawn becomes Hurricane Dawn and wipes out the East Coast.
Well, that seems unlikely. The Hurricane Center says so far, Tropical Storm Dawn is small and not particularly well organized.
They didn't really say that, did they?
Yes, they did.
Oh, man. What else do you have for us today that is less ironic?
In Canada.
All gone. Yeah, it's all gone, eh?
Just 1 year after catastrophic wildfires destroyed much of the town of Fort McMurray in Alberta's tar sands region, now next door in British Columbia, more than 36,000 people were evacuated on Sunday to escape wildfires driven by heat and high winds that have already destroyed an as yet unknown number of homes in and around southern British Columbia. There are now 160 active wildfires in British Columbia alone right now, and wildfires over in Alberta have closed parts of Banff and Kootenay National Parks. Officials are warning it's shaping up to be yet another record wildfire season.
And yet they continue to dig that
dirty tar sands oil out of Alberta?
Yes, they do.
And it will soon be heading to the U.S. via the Keystone XL pipeline?
Yes, it will.
Fantastic.
Bloomberg News has obtained a leaked draft of an electric grid reliability study that concludes that the rise of renewable energy does not undermine the reliability of our electric grid. It directly contradicts Energy Secretary Rick Perry, who ordered this study to question whether clean energy policies are unfairly pushing out polluting coal plants. The draft, written by Department of Energy staff, concludes renewables pose no threat and, quote, the power system is even more reliable today. The question now is how much of that draft will survive changes made by political appointees.
They can still change it before it gets released, but thanks to Bloomberg, we now know what the actual scientists think.
The Interior Department announced its first offshore oil and gas lease sale, opening up more than 70 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico for offshore drilling. And to sweeten the deal, the Trump administration reduced royalty rates paid by oil and gas companies for fossil fuels extracted from the public's holdings, claiming that reduced royalty rates are needed to encourage drilling at a time of low oil prices and help developers get a better return on their investment.
And help screw over the American taxpayer.
But some good news. In the House of Representatives, 46 Republicans bucked their leadership last week and joined with Democrats to defeat an anti-science amendment to the annual defense authorization bill. It would have barred the Defense Department from reporting on the impacts of climate change on military facilities.
So that is not barred. The military can still report on the menace of the climate crisis.
Indeed.
Good.
Thanks to Republicans.
Thank you, Republicans.
Finally, in Pennsylvania, an order of Catholic nuns has built an outdoor chapel to block a natural gas pipeline across their land, saying the pipeline is a violation of their long and deeply held religious beliefs and reverence for creation. Pipeline company Williams is suing to use eminent domain to seize land owned by the Sisters of the Adorers of the Blood of Christ to use for the Atlantic Sunrise Pipeline in order to export fracked natural gas overseas. In an interview with the broadcast, local Mennonite pastor Melinda Clatterbuck, a co-founder of the group Lancaster Against Pipelines, which has joined the nuns, said they will block them as long as they can.
If they gain that land possession, the community of believers are going to be in that chapel prayerfully protesting when Williams tries to take it over.
You go, ladies. I want to see the Trump administration take down those nuns in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Another trace.
The election of a Democratic write-in candidate over a Green Party candidate in a Pennsylvania state House race last year is under investigation by the Philadelphia DA and the state attorney general. According to the Philly Voice, Sherry Hunkala alleges that Democrats engaged in electioneering inside and outside of polling stations and that cash changed hands between Democratic poll workers and election officials, among other claims. Despite the investigations and Hunkala's lawsuit, the Democratic winner, Emilio Vasquez, was sworn in this spring. Hunkala is an anti-poverty activist who has run for a variety of offices as a Green in the past several years. She reaffirmed her claims against Vasquez and the Democrats recently at the annual meeting of the Green Party in New Jersey. For more, we go to Ann Garrison with our friends at KPFA Berkeley.
The U.S. Green Party held its annual meeting in Newark, New Jersey last weekend. Sherry Hunkala, Philadelphia Green and founder of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign, addressed the gathering about election theft in Pennsylvania's District 197, the poorest in the state. She first told the crowd about the three times she has run for office as a Green.
Okay, so I've been asked to say something about my experience in the Green Party running as a candidate. I ran for sheriff in Philadelphia. I stole that entire idea based on African-Americans in the South who ran to try and have impact on stopping the lynching. I then had the honor of running for vice president on the Green Party ticket. When people ask me what was that experience like, I'm sure Ajamu will join me in saying it's pretty much like getting hit by a Mack truck twice or three times, but it's a hell of an experience. And then most recently, I really went through a serious loss of innocence running in my own district for state representative in the 197.
She described epidemic drug abuse in the bleak post-industrial landscape of Pennsylvania District 197.
On the very block that I live, in the poorest district in the state of Pennsylvania, in Kensington, where maybe you've recently seen on the news with Dr. Oz coming, because there was 10,000 needles about 14 blocks from my house, where people shoot heroin in order to escape.
She also described corruption in the District 197 election.
I learned about what it means to really run for office in a frontline community that's run by the Democratic Party, also known as the local mob, and it has not a damn thing to do with Russia. And as they're talking about the Russians stealing the election, I'm watching the fact that they stole my election in the 197 district, and it's not appearing on any of the progressive media. You're not hearing about it on the radio shows. My election should have been a slam dunk. I ran against the local parking authority guy that nobody had a damn idea who the hell he was. And on election day, the joke was, Sherry, you didn't get the menu. You know what the menu was? How much money it cost each ward leader in order to get to a certain percentage in each of the voting booths. So as we went around and saw brothers and sisters being paid in between the housing projects, as we saw them pass out stamps for the other opponent from the seat inside the election booth, as we produced video after video after video of election judges getting paid money to ensure that I was not elected on election day, we made a decision to raise the necessary $7,000 and we're going to federal court.
That was Sherry Honkala, Philadelphia Green and founder of the Poor People's Economic Human Rights Campaign. The head of the local Democratic Party, she said, told her that she would be a state representative now if only she had become a Democrat. She needs to raise $7,000 to take her case to federal court. Since she swore to do so, her tires have been slashed, her life threatened, and she and her family have been evicted from public housing. In Berkeley, for Pacifica, KPFA Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
And now it's Climate Connections from our friends at the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. This week's spot focuses on a particular disease-ridden creepy crawly that has not been a major pest in Oregon, though warmer temperatures may change that.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. For many Americans, the ticks that transmit Lyme disease have replaced mosquitoes as summertime enemy number one. Janet Foley is a professor who studies infectious diseases at the University of California, Davis.
I grew up in Maine, and when I was a kid, there were no deer ticks ever. And Maine arguably has the worst epidemic in the United States right now of Lyme disease.
The problem is not just in Maine. Annual reported cases of Lyme disease in the U.S. have more than doubled over the past 20 years. Foley says part of the reason is that warmer winter temperatures have allowed the ticks to thrive in new areas. So more cases are now reported in places like upstate New York and the upper Great Lakes region.
The expansion north is certainly associated with climate change.
And it's not just rising temperatures. Changes in precipitation, humidity, and vegetation can also affect tick populations and the transmission of Lyme disease.
We're going to have to expect disease, whether it's Lyme disease or other diseases, to be a constant emerging problem that we have to deal with.
As the risks increase, she says it's more important than ever for people all over the country to learn how to prevent and treat tick-borne diseases. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
I don't drink coffee, I take tea, my dear. Some extra rice, please.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's What's Life Without Laughter. That's followed at 6:30 by Free Culture Radio. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather for Portland is a low of 60, with a high tomorrow of 77. Today in history, in 1979, two gigantic supertankers collided in the Caribbean Sea, killing 26 crew members and spilling 280,000 tons of crude oil into the sea. The quote of the day is from author and activist Bill McKibben. Global warming is no longer a philosophical threat, no longer a future threat, no longer a threat at all. It's our reality.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. The American Federation of Teachers, labor leaders from other unions, and members of Congress are rallying on Capitol Hill Wednesday to oppose education cuts and efforts to repeal the Affordable Care Act. AFT members and others will lobby members of Congress after the rally. American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten says as her union defends public education from charter school privatization attacks, it's only part of a much bigger David and Goliath struggle over public sector services. Weingarten says what's happening on a range of issues is that the public sector itself and the very idea of public, not-for-profit institutions is under assault from those who want to turn everything into unregulated private, for-profit markets.
We are in a David versus Goliath struggle with the people who believe that through solidarity and through some social contract that goes back to the founding of America, there are certain things that we do together to make America safe and to increase quality of life. One is public security, one is public education. I would argue that healthcare is part of that too.
Weingarten says working people need healthcare and a dependable social safety net.
We need to make sure that they have a safety net. We need to make sure that their health care is there and that they are not one illness away from bankruptcy.
Speaking on MSNBC, North Carolina NAACP President Reverend William Barber said that the recent laying on of hands and prayers by the Christian right for Donald Trump in the Oval Office borders on heresy. Reverend Barber says it's religious hypocrisy to pray for people who are hurting the poor.
It is a form of theological malpractice that borders on heresy. When you can pray for a president and others while they are prey praying on the most vulnerable, you are violating the most sacred principles of religion.
Reverend Barber quoted biblical text to underscore his point.
There's a text in Amos chapter 2 that says religious and moral hypocrisy looks like when a nation of political leaders will buy and sell upstanding people, when they will do anything to make money, when they will sell the poor for a pair of shoes, when they will grind the penniless into the dirt and shove the luckless into the ditch and extort from the poor. That's an actual text. There's a text that says when you do not care for the sick, you are actually violating the principles of God.
For more labor news, check out our new website at workersindependentnews.com.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now our friends at the Illinois Labor History Project bring us Labor History Into.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1993. That was the day that President Bill Clinton announced his Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He had campaigned for president, promising to allow all citizens to serve in the military, regardless of sexual orientation. Once he was elected, there was a great deal of opposition to his proposal. Military officials railed against the idea of lifting the ban on homosexuals in the military. Members of Congress and the public voiced opposition. President Clinton proposed a compromise he called Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This meant that military officials were not supposed to inquire about the sexual orientation of servicemen and women. Service members were not to be public about their sexual preference. This meant that if members of the LGBT community wanted to pursue a career in the military, they had to hide a significant part of who they were or risk losing their jobs. The policy stood in effect for nearly two decades. More than 12,000 officers lost their jobs because they refused to stay in the closet. It is also unknown how many more LGBT people decided not to apply for military service because of the discriminatory division. President Obama pledged to repeal the policy during his first election. It took 2 years after his election until Don't Ask, Don't Tell was finally ended by Congress. Some members of Congress issued dire warnings about repealing the discriminatory policy. But on the fifth anniversary of the repeal, President Obama issued this statement. Today, Americans can serve the country they love, no matter who they love. And openly gay, lesbian, and bisexual men and women in uniform make our military stronger and America safer.
Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Baltimore police appear to have been caught on camera planting drugs. A video now trending on YouTube shows three Baltimore police walking to an open backyard full of trash, where one officer plants drugs in a soup can. A chuckle from one of the officers can be heard as they return to the street, and it appears that the drug-planting officer, Richard Pinheiro, then attempts to turn on his camera, apparently unaware that it was already on. Officer Pinheiro can be heard after planting the drugs saying, quote, I'm going to check here, hold on, before going back to the yard and pretending to discover the can. The other police officers are seen following him about during the play acting, apparently observing nothing out of the ordinary. The video was publicly revealed by the Baltimore Public Defender's Office. A Baltimore police spokesman said today that police and prosecutors are investigating the incident. Charges against the drug possession defendant were dropped the day after the video was revealed to prosecutors. The same officer, however, was called in to court a week later to give evidence in another case. Similar incidents have been caught on camera in Brooklyn, Des Moines, and Massachusetts in the last few years. A press conference has been scheduled for later today to discuss the video evidence.
2 weeks ago, Representative Barbara Lee from California added an amendment to the 2018 Defense Appropriations Bill that would have repealed the 2001 authorization for use of military force. Last night, without debate or discussion, House Speaker Paul Ryan killed the amendment. In 2001, Lee was the only member of Congress to vote against the AUMF, which gave the George W. Bush administration authority to take military action against the alleged perpetrators of the September 11th attacks. The measure has since been used several times by the Obama and Trump administrations to authorize military actions throughout the Middle East without congressional approval. Representative Lee has been trying since 2001 to repeal this authorization and had felt having the amendment attached to the defense budget would accomplish that. Lee said today, quote, Congress has been missing in action on matters of war and peace for nearly 16 years. Republican leadership showed last night that they will do anything to maintain this status quo.
And now we bring you the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine, from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem. Today, we'll be playing This Week in Palestine, a roundup of news from the daily broadcasts, as well as new material. Eman Abidrabu Banura starts with news related to nonviolent actions. Then Rami El-Maghari looks at political news, and Ghassan Banura finishes the segment with events on the ground in West Bank and Gaza Strip.
We'll Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imc.org, for July 8th to the 14th, 2017. Seven Palestinians were killed by Israeli gunfire this week. As Palestinian president, he affirms his willingness for peace based on two-state solution. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report as usual with the non-violent activities organized in the West Bank. Israeli troops attacked anti-wall and settlement protests on Friday, organized at a number of West Bank villages using tear gas and rubber-coated steel bullets. In central West Bank, Israeli soldiers attacked protesters in Annabi Saleh before even leaving the village. At the nearby villages of Bil'in and Na'lin, residents and their supporters reached the Israeli wall. Soldiers stationed there showered them with tear gas and chemical water that generate bad smell. Many were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. In Kfar Kaddoum village in northern West Bank, Israeli troops attacked the villagers and their international supporters at the village entrance. Later, troops stormed the village and fired tear gas at protesters. Many civilians were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation. This week, in reaction to a Jerusalem-based raid fired between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas condemned the shootout. IMEMC's Ramya Al-Maghari has more.
Amidst an external tour, President Mahmoud Abbas of the Palestinian Authority condemned this week a shootout in the occupied East Jerusalem, where three Palestinian Arab young men were killed along with two Israeli soldiers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in East Jerusalem. Three young men from same family coming from the Umm al-Fahim Arab Israeli city reached the Al-Aqsa Mosque earlier on a Friday and began shooting at Israeli soldiers. The attack came following a series of Israeli settlers' attempts to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, backed by Israeli soldiers. Also, more recently, Israel has repeatedly declared that the East Jerusalem area will remain under exclusive Israeli control. U.S.'s ambassador to Israel, David Friedman, also condemned the attack. In wake of the incident, Israeli occupying authorities shut down the Al-Aqsa Mosque for the first time in the last 50 years of Israeli occupation of the Arab eastern city of Jerusalem. Within his non-stop communications with world leaders, President Abbas has met recently with the French, Chinese, and Egyptian officials, expressing willingness for peace that is based on a two-state solution which Washington had envisioned long time ago. In the Gaza Strip, leftist Palestinian factions called this week on both the West Bank-based Palestinian Authority and the Islamist ruling Hamas party in Gaza to agree among each other for the best of solving ongoing Gaza crisis in a way that would ease Gaza blockade. Currently, Gaza lives the worst ever electricity crisis with only 2 to 4 hours of supply per day. For IMEMC News, I am Rani Al-Mudari in Gaza.
Seven Palestinians were killed by Israeli army gunfire this week. 2 dozen others were reported injured. IMEMC's Ghassan Banoura reports.
4 Palestinians were killed by Israeli army gunfire in 2 separate incidents in Jerusalem and Bethlehem on Friday. Israeli police officers and soldiers shot and killed on Friday morning 3 young Palestinian men who opened fire on officers near the Tiberias Gate leading to Al-Aqsa Mosque in occupied East Jerusalem and fled towards the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, where they exchanged fire with soldiers, killing 2 officers and injuring 3 before they were killed. The 3 Palestinians were identified as Muhammad Jabarin, 29, Muhammad Hamad Jabarin, 19, and Muhammad Ahmad Jabarin, 19. Following the fatal incident, Israeli soldiers completely sealed Al-Aqsa Mosque, something that have not been done since Israel occupied the city in 1967 and cancelled the Friday prayers. On Friday at dawn, Bara Hawamda, 17, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers Two other youth were injured during clashes that took place during an invasion targeting the Hesher refugee camp south of Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. Later on Friday evening, Israeli soldiers injured 25 Palestinians after several army jeeps invaded the Abu Dis town east of occupied Jerusalem and clashed with dozens of youngsters. The soldiers fired many live rounds, rubber-coated steel bullets, gas bombs and concussion grenades at the protesters and surrounding homes. Earlier in the week, Israeli soldiers killed on Monday Mohammed Jibril, 25, from Taqwa town south of Bethlehem. The Israeli army claimed the Palestinian sped his car towards the soldiers who were exchanging guard duties at a military watchtower, wounding one soldier. Then Jibril got out of the car and tried to stab soldiers before he was gunned down by other troops. The Israeli army story was not confirmed by either surveillance videos or witnesses. Two more teenagers were killed during clashes that erupted as dozens of Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn Jenin refugee camp in the northern West Bank city of Jenin. Medical sources in Jenin said that soldiers killed Saad Salah, 21, from Jenin city and Aus Salama, 17, from the Jenin refugee camp after shooting them with live fire during the clashes. A third youth was critically injured. During the week, Israeli forces conducted at least 50 military invasions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank and Jerusalem. During these invasions, Israeli troops detained at least 33 Palestinian civilians, including three children. In Gaza, Israeli soldiers shot and injured on Monday two young Palestinian men, including one who suffered serious injury during clashes that erupted east of Jabalia town in the northern part of the coastal region. For IMEMC News, this is Ghassan Bannoura.
That's all for today from This Week in Palestine, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.amnc.org. This week's report has been brought to you by George Rashmawi and me, Iman Abdrabbo Bannoura.
KBOO News poet Dan Raphael may have overdosed on climate news.
The sky is melting as the seas rise and die, as more and more people with less and less to eat crowd into cities that will continue to break down, where all the powerless can do is assault each other. If we're all too depressed to leave our rooms, will that lower carbon emissions? Money doesn't breathe. It's safe unless the earth gets hot enough to melt gold to erase global banking's memory of mathematical riches. Money says, keep drilling, keep logging. Overpopulation means cheap labor. Rage, rage against the dying of the light, the killing of the planet, and love, love with the heat of the natural sun. Only love and magic can save us from the mechanized meanness of global greed. Today the earth is still beautiful. Today there's still hope. And when we wake up tomorrow, it will be today again. For Poetic and Climate Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Teresa Mitchell, and myself, Sam Bowman. The producer is Sam Bowman, filling in for Kyle Qureshi. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 is Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty, a look at how the criminal justice system impacts the lives of African American boys and men at every stage, from arrest through sentencing, with Professor Angela J. Davis, author of Policing the Black Man. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Jake Ramos welcomes Portland author Omar El Akkad and his new novel, American War, a story that asks, what might happen if America were to turn its deadliest weapons against itself in a second civil war? Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO, with news from your community radio station.
Yes, it is that time again, right around 5:45 on a Wednesday. News from the Boo, where we hear about items of interest happening in and around the KBOO community. Today, we have Gil Cardone with us. Welcome.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Gil.
And Gil has brought a special guest. Would you like to introduce?
Totally. So today's special guest is Jill Blanchard.
Welcome,
Yay.
Jill.
Hi. Welcome, Jill.
Jill's one of our events work group leads. She's a volunteer, has been very fantastic, and a lot of great help and support. Thank you, Jill.
Of course. It's my pleasure to do anything I can for the KBOO community.
Wonderful. So, Jill, why don't you tell us a bit about what brought you to KBOO originally, how long you've been around, and what kind of things you've been doing in the community?
I've been in Portland for 14 years, and I've always known about KBOO, and I figured I'd end up here eventually, and so I did about a year ago. And I'm so excited to meet such a great collection of folks, such a great collection of news, such a great collection of community outreach, and I think that it's finally... I'm here, and I'm giving what I can, and it makes me very happy.
So, well, I'm curious what the impetus was. You knew about KBOO for a long time. What made you finally send that email or show up at the station?
I have a friend who was very close to the station about 2 years ago, and she